book in the Old Testament. Book of Prophecy. Let me pull up my notes. I'm excited that we're going over this book, especially on the one-year anniversary of the attacks from Hamas on Israel and Israel's heavy-handed response. So I'm going to, much like we were talking about in the sermon, I'm not condoning a heavy-handed response. I'm not saying it wasn't warranted for us to be mindful and watching. Again, as ambassadors, it is not our role to become engaged in the proceedings of the nation for which we are not citizens, right? And so for us to look at the world around us, this is where we get to the point where we look and we see what's going on, and we can sigh and we can cry and we can say, oh, man, a country. I do wish we'd have more people going to that nation. And that's where we're all looking forward to the time that God is going to bring about with His Son's return, where He's going to initiate, if you will, a mass exodus towards His way. All right, let me see here. All right, by a webcast watcher, that the top of my head is cut off. I've been lobotomized, and that's what you do to your pastor when he's gone for so long. That's all right. It's just a crew cut. So, yeah, I'm a lot better. So, all right. Well, I think most people who are going to be here for the study are getting situated. And I appreciated Mr. Apardian's prayer and asking the blessing on the Bible study, so we're going to go with that. Appreciate that. Today, just depending on how vigorous your questions are and interaction is, we might just get through the background and not even touch the book. It just depends. So, as I mentioned earlier, I think this is such an intriguing book to dive into, given the unrest that we see in the Middle East. We can do that right now. We got some handouts that are be coming around. I got a couple different maps that I'll reference here in this. Yeah, we can go ahead and pass those both out. Mr. Kiesel and Mr. Parting have them. If they get past you and you don't have anything, make sure you vigorously wave at them and let them know. Yeah, vigorously. So, the book of Obadiah, as I mentioned, is the shortest book in the Old Testament. It means servant of the Lord. Now, there is some uncertainty as to when the book was written. You might find this to be a common theme for every single book of the minor prophets. You're all wondering when they are written. This actually happens with all prophetic books, because you have individuals arguing for them being written later to justify that's how they knew that was going to happen. But here, when we're talking about the book of Obadiah, we have a couple different timelines that we're talking about. Some believe that this is the same Obadiah who Elijah interacted with, who served under King Ahab. If you remember that, back at that time, you have the prophet Obadiah, and Elijah actually meets up with him and says, "Hey, go tell Obadiah I'm here." And Obadiah is like, "Do you even know what's been going on? He's got a price on your head. If I go see him, what are you trying to do? Get me killed? I'm sitting here trying to keep 100 prophets in a cave alive." Right? So there are these people who Obadiah is serving and helping, but that would put this book somewhere around mid-800s BCE. So 875, 853, sometime there during the reign of Ahab, if that is the same Obadiah. Some believe that this Obadiah was contemporaries with Hosea, Joel, and Amos. Those also being minor prophets. We've gone through Hosea, Joel, and Amos in our minor prophets series so far. That would put this somewhere around 790 to 720 BCE. So again, before the Christian era, before the common era, we're looking at the possibility of this being an Obadiah who is contemporaries with them. And that being the case, that, remember, Hosea, Joel, and Amos are preaching to the northern 10 tribes. Joel and Amos were both doing that. Amos we had was a little bit Amos was a little bit more direct, a little less flowery, like Hosea is known for being a wonderful literary work. But if it's at that time, again, we're looking at 790 to 720 BCE, both of these being before the fall of the Southern Kingdom. And in the third timeline that is a possibility is coming in around the time of Jerusalem's destruction, and that is around 586 BC. Now, the reason that we have different postulated occurrences for this, we'll get into when we're looking at the actual text of it. Now that we're solidly into the introduction, I'll make an announcement that I forgot to make before. Yolanda has brought produce. I was wondering, I was like, my hand keeps touching my notebook. I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget. So there's produce, and that is going to be in the kitchen for folks afterwards. If you'd like produce, snag it in the kitchen afterwards. Compliments of God's blessings to Yolanda with her garden. All right, so back to Obadiah. This is a vision. God speaks to his people through a number of ways, visions being one of those. So this is the vision of Obadiah, and it is what God has revealed to him. And there's an amazing level of detail. At times God gives all the information, and at times God does not give it. Much like he says to the workers in the vineyard who agreed to work for a denarii for an entire day, and then those who agreed to work for a denarii for just the last hour, he says, it's my gift. Can't I give it to whom I want? Did you not agree to this? Right? So God gives a level of understanding and a level of detail to any vision that he wants for that particular purpose. If you consider the 70 weeks prophecy in the book of Daniel, that is a very detailed prophecy for which you can figure out when the Messiah is coming onto the stage in the world. That's an amazingly detailed prophecy. We've gone over that. I did that last fall. I won't dive into that. But it's a very detailed prophecy. You go through Revelation. A very detailed prophecy. And this is why people will start playing the numbers games and trying to predict when Christ is going to return, when God's going to send him back. Because we're looking and we're saying, oh, is this the first bowl? Is this the first woe? Is this the trumpet? And so we start looking at those things. So again, God is going to divulge things at whatever level of detail that he would like. What we get in the book of Obadiah is actually interesting because you don't often get this. I shouldn't say you don't often get this. With prophecy, you often get this, but just as far as books in general. One of the things they do when you're talking about literary works, especially historical literature, is they will try to find corroborating manuscripts. And this is one of the difficulties that you will have with the Bible, is because people see this as one book, which it is, because it's the Word of God from one author, even though it's recorded by multiple scribes, if you will, for the people who wrote it down. But it is one text from God, but you have them across time. So if they were independent scrolls and independent books all by themselves, people are like, oh, well, you have corroborating evidence over here. This matches with this, matches with this, matches with this, and be like, oh, that's amazing. You know, nobody's corroborating what you see in the in Hammurabi's code. We're like, oh, that's amazing. The people had laws like this, but they look at the Bible and they're like, oh, that's archaic because it doesn't have corroborating items. Anyway, so with the book of Obadiah, what we have is a lot of corroboration between other books. If you turn to Isaiah 34, verses 5 through 17, we see here, Isaiah 34, verses 5 through 17, says, for my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Indeed, it shall come down on Edom and on the people of my curse for judgment. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is made overflowing with fatness, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah, and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. The wild oxen shall come with them, and the young bulls with the mighty bulls. Their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust saturated with fatness. For this is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the cause of Zion. So we get a bit of the backstory. This goes on all the way through verse 17. If you wanted to jot down as a reference, Jeremiah 49, but all of them, again, the theme here of the book of Obadiah being the destruction of Edom. Now, there are what I would say two overarching segments of the book. It is a single chapter, but there are two segments of this book, the first being proclamations against Edom, and the second being in the midst of the proclamations against Edom. God lays in there also the promises to his people, Israel. Within the proclamations to Edom, I would break that down into four segments. Okay, proclamations against Edom being the first part. There are four segments there. Their pride is going to be humbled. Verses 2 to 4, their pride is going to be humbled. Verses 5 through 7, their wealth will be plundered. Edom's pride will be humbled in verses 2 to 4. Their wealth will be plundered in verses 5 through 7. Their wisdom will be lost, verses 8 through 9. Spiteful behavior toward Israel will be avenged in verses 10 through 16. And then the second part, the promises to Israel. Two parts there. They'll be restored and rule over Edom, and that is in verses 17 through 20. Israel will be verses 17 through 20. And then God's kingdom will be established by the Messiah in verse 21. So that'd be the overarching organization there for the book of Obadiah. Again, proclamations against Edom, promises to Israel, and then the breakdown within them. A lot of the discussion when we're talking about Edom and the book of Obadiah is the question of who was Edom. Now, that might seem like a moot question in this crowd, but I think it's interesting for us to go over again with the backdrop of what we see happening in the world today and a little bit of understanding of human nature, because sometimes we forget. And I'll say I've had a lot of conversations with people, probably namely when you're talking about dating within the Church of God or outside of the Church of God community, and people are like, well, so-and-so was married and they married somebody who went to thus and such college, was baptized for this long. And I'll just say, well, we're trying to hedge our bets by somebody who ascribes to the same perspective, but there is no guarantee, because at the core, people are people, right? There's very clear examples in Scripture where God picks people out of other nations and from other places and clearly puts them in his body. I think that Tamar, Ruth, and Rahab are great examples of that, placed into not only his body, but also the lineage of Jesus Christ. But people are people. And we need to remember that we all have that core component of human nature that is wicked and deceitful. Who can know it? And so, when we remember that, I want us to have that as the backdrop for what we're going to read as we look at the history between Edom, also known as Esau, as we will get to, and Israel. So let's go back to Genesis 25. You thought we would be reading Obadiah? Haha. Genesis 25. Because I think it's nice to get the backstory to these things. I mean, coming from a guy who spent 4 months going over the birth story of Jesus Christ leading up to Passover, you wouldn't expect anything less, so I don't want to disappoint. All right, Genesis chapter 25. Verse 19, it runs through verse 34. This is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. Now Israel pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If all is well, why am I like this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." This is interesting because, again, the backdrop of when we went over the genealogy and the back history for Jesus Christ, Elizabeth as well, you have the women responding very differently when they find out what's going on. And we see that Mary, when she learned of these things, she had the discussion with the angel. When Elizabeth learned of these things, and they kept it in their heart, it said. And here we have a woman who goes to God. She's like, what if, I mean, this is a, if this is an okay pregnancy, I mean, what's going on? And so she has this prophecy, regarding the twins that she has in her womb. So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red. The word there is Edom. So Edom meaning red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Edom, or Esau. Literally meaning red. And afterward his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So they waited 20 years for her to get pregnant, because he was 40 when they got married, she was barren, and they couldn't have kids for 20 years. So we have quite a long time here. But now they've been married. Isaac is 60 years old when she bore them. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field. But Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Yeah, always pick the underdog, right? She knew the younger was gonna, the older was gonna serve the younger. No, but, so she's loving Jacob, and in all good, family dramas, we have favoritism going on. So it works really well if you're trying to figure out how to parent or how to be friends. Make sure that everybody knows who your favorite is. If you don't know, I've made this joke before, but it's also very true. If you don't know who the favorite is of your parents, it's because it was you. And everybody else, all the other kids in the family, know that it was you. And it bothers him egregiously. So everybody knows who the favorite is. They know who the favorites are. They know who to go to ask for ice cream. They know who's going to help them out. Go to mom, go to dad. Each of the kids has one. So, verse 29, Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that same red stew, for I am weary. Therefore his name was called Edom. Again, same word, literally meaning red. So Esau meaning hairy, red and hairy. It's interesting when you start going into the Hebrew words and the usage here. It's red stew, red. It's a red lentil stew. It's a red man, and I'm not going to. I keep recommending. I'm not recommending movies, but if you've seen the movie Inside Out. With the, they have the emotions, and they personify these emotions within the child. And what color do we associate red with? Anger. If somebody, and we now have our third child has red hair, and you know what many people's comments have been? Well, has that redhead streak come through yet? What is it associated with? I'm not offended by it. Don't worry about it, Nancy. So, people associate it with like, oh, you got red hair, you've got a short fuse, you've got a temper. People are like, red, they're hot-headed. So, I don't know how much of this is it goes back a ways, but I mean, those things are, we call them old wives' tales. It goes back a ways. And here we have Esau, red lentil stew. And we see how Esau responds to things. I'm not saying he wasn't provoked, but Esau responds to things in a way. And he says, please feed me with a red stew, for I'm weary. Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. And Esau said, look, I'm about to die, so what is this birthright to me? And Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. So he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob, and Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. I think I've made this, this is a math thing, right? We know that later on, Jacob has 12 sons, right? Now the concept of the birthright is that the eldest takes on the mantle of the family's all of them, being the responsible one, the one who's supposed to care for his mother and any of the daughters until they are wed. The oldest is supposed to do that. They kind of inherit the family business. Now, when you have 12 people, 12 sons, because generally the daughters were armed servants who could go and fight, he had enough wealth. That's a pretty good, you know, if you got a small business, you got 300 employees, you're doing all right. You're passing that along to your son. So Isaac got all of that. Well, Ishmael, you know, he did care for him a little bit, but Ishmael was taken care of as the angel gave the prophecy to Hagar about what was going to happen to Ishmael. He was reminded and consoled, saying, you know, I'm not going to forget him. But all of Abraham's inheritance in his household went to Isaac. So Isaac had all of that. So it wasn't nothing. But for somebody to say, you know what, I'm going to die, what is the use? I think hyperbole, right? Oh, I'm about to die, I'm despising it. Now, backdrop. Rebecca knew that the older would serve the younger. Rebecca knew that that is a prophecy from God, not something because of your favoritism in the family. And this is where we start seeing human nature just come in, and I just like drop the warning. All the legs are there. She is... I have a hard time believing, given the story and the context here, that she didn't share some of the things. It's just me. It's not written in the words, but you see that there's some tension between the two. And what Jacob does, and it's very, very important for us to distinguish, at this point, what Jacob has purchased for the price of a bowl of stew is the birthright. The birthright is the physical wealth of the family, where you would give a double portion to the firstborn and a single portion to all of the other sons. We're talking about the physical monetary wealth of the family is the birthright. This is not a blessing. And you need to distinguish between the two when we're talking about this. And we're looking at the backstory between Jacob and Esau. Okay? So here he gets the birthright. Let's go to chapter 27 here in Genesis. Genesis 27. We'll pick it up in verse 27. Genesis 27, verse 27. So, Isaac is wanting to bless his children. He's seeing the time of his death being imminent. And so what we have here in the lead up to verse 27 is Esau goes out to go get one of the deer, the venison that his father likes. Jacob, at the behest of his mother, now is going after the blessing, which is different than the birthright. Okay? So, verse 27, Jacob came near, kissed him, he smelled the smell of his clothing and blessed him and said, surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field, which the Lord has blessed. Therefore may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you. And herein, this is the blessing that is given to Jacob. Now, Isaac was thinking he's giving this to Esau. Now, this is one of those interesting things. I don't know how God would have worked it out. But if God says to Rebecca, when she's pregnant, the older is going to serve the younger. You have two nations there. They're going to be great peoples. This is what happens when you go to try to make things yourself. And we have records in scripture here of Abraham doing that with Ishmael and with Hagar and Ishmael, he and Sarah trying to make it happen themselves. Here we have Isaac and Rebekah. Oh, you said that? Well, I'll try to make that happen. And sometimes we can do that too. It's like, oh, I'm pretty sure I can discern God's will here. And I'll just tell you, I'm really bad at predicting that myself. very bad at it. And so I can just say, pray and fast. That would be my recommendation for all of us as we're trying to seek God's will. It is not about us getting done. You can go read James 4 about this, about praying and fasting, and Isaiah 58, about trying to do things ourselves and bend God's will to us. That is not what he says. James 4 says, draw near to me, draw near to God, and then he will draw near to you. It's not God coming over to you and like, oh, what are you doing over there, Nathan? Oh, I think I'll bless that. No, it's we draw near to God, and we say, hey, God, what would you like me to do? Where would you like me to go? And in this case, Rebecca's going like, well, let me infer, I suppose that Rebecca is going like, oh, I remember what God said to me. He's giving the blessing now. I need to make sure that the younger is there to receive that blessing. So she goes about and makes it happen. And we get a lot of consternation that flows on from that. Verse 30 here. Now it happened as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, that Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. He also had made savory food and brought it to his father and said to his father, let my father arise and eat of his son's game that your soul may bless me. And his father Isaac said to him, who are you? So he said, I am your son, your firstborn, Esau. Then Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, who? Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came and have blessed him, and indeed he shall be blessed. When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me also, O my father. And he said, your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing. And Esau said, is he not rightly named Jacob, or supplanter? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing. And he said, have you not reserved a blessing for me? Then Isaac answered and said to Esau, indeed, I have made him your master, and all his brethren I have given to him. And servants, as servants, with grain and wine I have sustained him. What shall I do now for you, my son? And Esau said to his father, have you only one blessing, my father? Bless me also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth, and of the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother, and it shall come to pass, when you become restless, that you shall break his yoke from your neck. So it's an interesting exchange there. I think that nested in that is what I had said at the beginning, a bit of human nature. And this I like to go back to because it's so important. Esau says in verse 36, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing. Is that an accurate representation of what happened? Now you sold your birthright. Now can I help it? If I am a good salesman, or I'd like to buy when the market is low and sell when the market is high, right? Jacob was just a shrewd negotiator. Jacob was saying, hey, I see opportunity. Esau could have said, are you insane? I can fast another half hour. I'm not about to die. Or maybe he was about to die, and he says, are you kidding? I'm your brother. But he says, what's it to me? Jacob didn't take it. Now, Jacob was very willing to throw that out there. I think that this is beyond what was there as the prophecy that Rebekah heard with the younger ruling over the elder. This is above and beyond. This is, dare I say, this is why I think that perhaps Rebekah had shared some of these things, because this is like the knife in the side. If you already know that you're going to rule over your brother, you're going to have your cake and eat it too. You're going to take the last bit of thing from him. Why are you going to do that? So this is pretty smarmy of Jacob. But at the same time, human nature is we look back on things and we remember that other time you stabbed me in the back. But okay, I'm not going to admit and accept my culpability in how that went down. Mr. Salmon, you had something.
Yeah, it really strikes me because Abraham obviously tried to teach Isaac God's way, and you would think that Esau would say, hey, are you going to murder me or allow me to die? Isn't that kind of against God's laws and stuff? None of that's ever said.
Well, we only get what I would call Cliff's Notes in this. Very, very little is given, but what we do get is we get the gist of the understanding of it. We see that he, as it says, despised his birthright. We see him not taking responsibility for selling it. Now, he is right that Jacob has supplanted him in stealing the blessing, right? The blessing is something that is, again, separate from the birthright. And so he is correct in Jacob supplanting him there. But then what we see is, verse 46, let's just do this. So Jacob escapes, verse 41 on, through. So Esau, actually let's read verse 41. So Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, then I will kill my brother Jacob. So as soon as the prescribed amount of time is done, the death of Isaac, he's going to go out and he's going to kill his brother. So Rebekah goes ahead and has her son head off to her uncle's. But then we see verse 46. Rebekah says to Isaac, I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob takes a wife of the daughters of Heth, like those who are the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? She's like, I don't want him to marry these local girls. I want him to go and marry someone from somewhere else. So don't take somebody from Canaan. Verse in chapter 28, verse 1, Isaac called Jacob, blessed him, charged him, said to him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. So go back, find somebody from the land. And then what we see is, so he sends him away. So there is a bit of time between the blessing. So there's going to be tension at home because Jacob's around long enough to send off, Isaac's around long enough to send Jacob off to go up to his brother-in-law's, up to Laban's. Verse 6 here, we see a little bit insight, like Mr. Samuel was bringing up, into how Esau operates. Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take himself a wife from there, and that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge, saying, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. He's like, oh, duly noted, I was listening. Also, Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac. So Esau went to Ishmael, his uncle, and took Mahalah, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's sister, and sister of Nebajath, to be his wife, in addition to the wives he had. All right, so he's trying to... So here's how I'm going to go ahead and fix this. I'm going to get back on mom and dad's good side by taking a wife that they approve of, which we read into this, Rebecca did not approve of his other wives that he already had. So now he's like, well, I'll get one that she does approve of. And so this is kind of like a human tendency. We can go and like try to fix wrong with a seemingly not as wrong. And so that's what Esau does. So an interesting thing here to note, though, is that as we go through this, let's jump to chapter 31 in Genesis. Genesis 31, beginning in verse 1. If you look at the first map, you can kind of see, first map, you don't know it. Jacob's journey to Haran and back. If you look at that map, you'll see there where Haran was. This is, again, you think about where Abram was called in Ur of the Chaldeans, and he came up from there, and he came down all the way, and he walked the length and the breadth of the land that God had promised that he's going to give him. And he's down there where Isaac is living in the area down there in Beersheba, which is to the west of the Dead Sea or the Salt Sea. And so Isaac, as he leaves town so as not to die / find a wife, he goes north all the way up to Haran. Okay, now Genesis 31 verse 1, he's been there a while, some say 20 years, we know that it's at least 14, not sure exactly how much longer it is than that, or how much, you know, it's not shorter than that, because he served 7 years for Rachel, and surprise, surprise, it was Leah, then he serves another 7 for Rachel again. So he's there at least 14, but clearly it is longer, because he's there a bit longer after that time. With his flocks and things like that, as he's considering his ways. Some people will put it right around the 20 years of time frame. But chapter 31 of Genesis, Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken all away that was our father's. And from what was our father's, he has acquired all his wealth. Now, this is an interesting thing, just this introduction. When's the last time that we saw Laban? Anybody? It's when Eliezer of Damascus shows up with camels and is looking for a wife for his master's son. Remember that? And what does he do with Laban the Syrian? First, he puts bracelets of gold and earrings all on Rebekah, right? Because she had watered the camels. God clearly shows what's happening. And then he goes and he pulls out more and he gives it. Laban is functioning as the intermediary there, an agreement as to whether or not Rebekah can go and be Isaac's wife. But he gives great gifts to Laban the Syrian. And then he takes, according to Rebekah's willingness, takes her back home. So he gave a very good dowry for Rebekah. And that was given to the household that Laban is still running up here in Paddan Aram. So that's the last time we've seen Laban. And now we have 14 to 20 years worth of work. We know that for the first seven, it seemed as if nothing was going on, right? But Jacob works for 7 years. He wasn't building his own wealth. If you go back to the bit of the story when Jacob's talking about it, he's there. He's like, you know what? Let's build my uncle's wealth. He's going to be there. He's going to, instead of going to go find other work, he says, I'll work in my uncle's house and we'll keep this all within the family sort of thing. Works another seven. And it's not until after that he starts to say, you know what? I think maybe I've got kids. I've got a family. There's starting to be some consternation between the shepherds. I think we're going to have to go in part. I would like my wages. And then Laban changes the wages. I think it was like 10 times. I'd have to go back and look in scripture to see. Oh, yeah, verse 7. Let's just read. Chapter 31, verse 1. We'll read this again. So Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all this wealth. And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Because before, Laban was saying, whoa! The Lord is blessing me because he's blessing you. Laban recognized it beforehand, but something has soured. So then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers, to your family, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock, and said to them, I see your father's countenance. It is not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my father's father has been with me. And you know that with all my might I have served He says, and you know that with all my might I have served your father, yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. So we get into how things have changed. So Jacob leaves the household of Isaac. When he leaves the household of Isaac, it's shortly before the death of his father. We know that they came back together to bury their father, but then Isaac is away. Jacob is away. So when he's away, Esau is now in Israel area, the promised land area. So is Rebekah. So is all the wealth because Jacob left. It says at the beginning, with nothing but the clothes on his back, because he was like, I don't want to die. So this is a big thing. Remember, there's the birthright, and there's the blessing. Only one of those two things was promised to him through the prophecy that was given to Rebekah. And that was the blessing side of things, where he was going to be greater than his older brother. When he leaves home, he did not take the birthright. He did not take his portion. It says clearly that he left with the clothes on his back because he was scared of his brother. That Jacob was blessed with in blessing the household of Laban got frittered away, and all that was left was clearly Jacob's stuff, regardless of how Laban tried to shift the payment structure and his earnings. Laban is just like choking the golden goose sort of thing, and there's nothing left. And so his servants see it, his daughters see it, and he goes. But it's also, if you have an individual who is shrewd, I don't know a lot about how Jacob interacted, but you have likely interacted with someone that they just grate, and you're just like, And it's hard to imagine sticking around with them a little bit longer. And perhaps Jacob was like this early on in his life because he has this effect on his brother to where his brother looks back and says, fits his name. That's exactly who he is. And now he's over here with his uncle and they're like, wow, throw him under the bus. They're not saying, well, you know what? No, we were very blessed, but I'll tell you what, Laban's been really bad with the finances. They're not looking at it and saying like, you know, maybe you'll hire us, Jacob. What they're saying is you took it all. And so there's just this knowledge that people's memories will get clouded, when there's a possibility of their shortcomings, but it also puts more, all that much more pressure on us to be a light, to be the right kind of individual who's not going to leave that taste in the mouth of someone that they go be like, ah, classic Christian, classic Nathan, whatever it is there, to where it's a bad taste, because we're supposed to be savory. We're supposed to be salt that doesn't lose its flavor, that light that draws people in. And so we're seeing here these individuals who are trying to shuffle, barge their way into making the blessings happen that God has said are going to happen. But they're like, I know how to get that. I know how to make that for myself. And instead what they're doing is only making for themselves more consternation down the road. So we have poor memory on both parts for Laban and for Esau, because Jacob didn't take a lick with him when he went. He only took the clothes on his back. When he left with whatever the final payment agreement was, his wages agreement were with Laban, and he goes. The only thing extra that he got with him were the household idols that Rachel was hiding underneath of her camel saddle, right? So that's the only extra stuff that he got from that. But then he goes back. And it's an interesting thing. So he's coming down from Haran. He's coming south. Now, this is Nathan's supposition again. Take it for what it's worth. But I think when we're talking about human nature, if you hear your dad is dead, you're Esau, right? You hear that he's coming back from where he has been for the last 14 to 20 years. And you're like, what do you think he's coming back for? He left with nothing. At the very least, he's taken 33%. He might want the whole 67. And so what we see is we see Esau meeting him with, I think it's 400 armed men. He's got 100 more than his grandpa had. He goes to go meet Jacob on his way back from Haran. And it's such an intriguing thing, because he's going to protect, in my estimation, everything that's his. And so when Jacob starts sending things, he's saying, oh, no, I'm not coming to get your stuff. That's why he's sending these gifts off. He actually ends up paying. So finally, Esau's like, I don't need it. I've got plenty. Of course you have plenty. You got 67% more than you should have based on what you sold, right? But he actually accepts, finally, what Jacob offers. When Jacob lays out, he's like, again, plain favorites, sets out, you know, the children of Leah's handmaid, and then the children of Rachel's handmaid, and then Leah and her children, and then finally Rachel and her children. And so he lays it out, but in front of them, they're all bearing gifts and sending them. And so Esau actually accepts those. So Esau accepts more from Jacob than even what would have been his. And Jacob has what he has because God blessed him while he was in the land of Rebekah's family there, serving under Laban. So it's an intriguing thing. But in the mind of Edom and Esau, there's this continual thought, you took something of mine that was mine. But he didn't. What was taken, though, is what was promised to him beforehand. But this is what happens when we go and we try to force God's outcome, what God says the outcome is going to be, if it is us who puts it into play, we are going to bear the frustration. We are going to be the ones who bear the recourse, the anger, the vitriol for it happening. And that's where it's like God said to Israel when they're going into the promised land, I didn't want you to see any war. I would have driven them out with hornets. Because, I mean, if you go and you take over a country, let's say, hypothetically, Russia comes in, with a bunch of bees come across the Ukrainian border into Russia, or across the Ukrainian border from Russia, and drive a bunch of people out. Clear the entire country. Are people going to be like, Russia did that? That's kind of hard. How are you going to, like, that doesn't seem probable. Who said you're controlling that? It's just bees, right? God says, I would have driven them out with hornets. It's hard to attribute that to any one person, right? We say, that's crazy. That wouldn't be how that happens. But if we go and we make it happen, well, God says he has promised this portion and this to us, so therefore I'm going to go get it. That's the wrong mindset. that is similar to the mindset of Simon the magician. It's like, oh, I see what you're doing there. I want that power. Give that power to me. And that's what he was telling the apostles at that time. Yeah, Dan.
It's a fascinating learning in his life because it seems like he was the manipulator at a minimum when he was with his brother, and then he was kind of one-upped by an even bigger manipulator to get humbled by that, and then of course wrestled with Christ to again be humbled. So by the time he came home, he was realizing where his wealth would come from and where his success would come from, and all those years were needed to shape him.
Mm-hmm.
His brother was jealous and lived his life in jealousy as if he'd always been wronged, and that continues to today of people who always feel like they're wronged.
Yeah, and that is one of the hardest things to overcome, is if we have what is called a victim mentality, that we have been wronged. It is so hard, and I would say nigh on impossible, to take that and remove that, because that feeling of being wronged, it just creeps into your psyche. And I think it's interesting because even up to the... Sorry, did you have something to say? Go ahead.
Because they say, I deserve it, and he stole it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't get out of it. I deserve that.
And yeah.
Wrong.
Yeah, and again, we see there in the moment when he's just at his... When Esau is at his most raw, he says, Father, bless me also. Is there nothing left? He's taken this other thing from me. It's like... you sold it, right? And it's just the wrong memory. But we will rewrite, and you can witness this in people who are hurt when we're so emotionally scarred by something. You will watch people, and if you listen, you'll hear them rewrite history to justify their position more concretely. And they will say, "Oh, I've mentioned this with divorce before, but if you have a couple who is divorced, if you have a relationship that goes sour, there will be something that you say, the straw that breaks the camel's back. But then if you stick around and you're still friends with either of the individuals on whom that relationship has gone sour, you will find that the marker moves farther and farther back where they can see clearly the other person was undercutting me, was supplanting me, was doing these other things, all the way up through. But in the moment, they would say, like, this is what it is. And then it'll be like, even back here they were doing this. Even back here they were doing this. And they substantiate their position. This is human nature. You and I will do the same thing if we aren't brought into... This is why good friends, a friend that sticks closer to a brother who's going to call you out when you do it. This is why we need each other. Because we do this. This is what we do. This is how we function. What Esau and Edom are doing is no different than what anybody else does. But it's very much on display here as we look over the millennia of what has happened. And I think it's intriguing also. We are getting to see the growth, the interaction that he has with Esau is, you know what? No. That's all right. We'll catch up. But he never goes and follows Esau. Esau goes back down to Edom. So if you look at the second map, and if you guys want to hold on to these, I think it'd be wonderful. Go back to the first map. Don't do the second map. Blue line here at the bottom, going from Mount Seir up to Peniel and Sukkoth. This is the route that Esau is taking with his 400 armed guys coming up to head off or to intersect with Jacob coming back. The way that blue line actually mimics a lot of what you do if you go to the second page. You'll see here, you look at where Edom is, you look right back to where what would be I'm looking at the cities of the guy, Bozrah. So to the northern part of the green area that is on the second map for the land of Edom. You've got Edom, Moab, Ammon to the north. But in Edom, you see Bozrah there. You see Bozrah down close to Mount Seir in the bottom of the first map. But what you see, that dotted line, you'll see the different highways. That dotted line going at the point of Israel's departure from Egypt. That was a main thoroughfare road. It meant you didn't have to go all the way over to the sea. You could just go straight down. And so that's the expedient way that Esau goes up to intercept Jacob and his group coming down. All right? I think it also is interesting to point out, you know, in light of the sermon that I gave today talking about taking up arms versus diplomacy. And we see that Esau came with not his whole household going, oh, brother, come and see the family that I had. He comes with 400 armed men to protect what is his. But we do see Jacob functioning with a little bit of wisdom, I would say. He didn't have armed men. He definitely had servants. But what he does is he sends through the gifts. And this is where the apples of gold and settings of silver, the honey, you can turn away wrath with a soft answer. All of these principles of how to interact with one another. Thankfully, Jacob is using it this time. But so he goes. He doesn't go back down to Edom, but he goes into the area of Shechem. So he doesn't go back with his brother. Instead, goes over to Shechem. Couple of references here when we're talking about Edom and Israel. I'll just kind of give these as we're wrapping up-ish. Deuteronomy 2, verses 1 through 6. Deuteronomy 2, verses 1 through 6. God tells Israel how to deal with Esau and with Edom. He says, you know, don't get aggressive with them. Be kind to them. He's telling Israel how to deal with Edom. Deuteronomy 23, verse 7, he instructs Israel how to treat the Edomites. And then what we've been talking about here as far as the departure from Egypt during the Exodus, that is found in Numbers 20, verses 14 through 21. And that's where Edom refused passage for Israel. Israel said, we'll go by the king's highway. This was not just a small thing. This was a recognized trade route. They said, we'll go by the king's highway. Edom's like, take a hike. We'll pay for, I mean, we'll bring our own water. We'll supply ourselves. We'll do nothing. We'll only pay for, you know, we'll buy everything that we use. It's kind of like what Dave is talking to Hiram when he's trying to get the cedars and all this stuff. He's like, and he overpays, I guess it was Solomon, and he overpays for things, make sure it's all, he's like, well, we'll take care of it. They're like, nope. Take a hike. So they would not let them go through the land of Edom. There was such animosity towards them. Another reference, this is an initial part of the fulfillment of the prophecy that was given to Rebekah. And that is in 2 Samuel 8, verse 14. David actually ruled over Edom. He ruled over, there are a number of fortresses that he put in place in the land of Edom, and he ruled over Edom while he was also king of Israel. So he did rule over Edom as well. And then Psalm 137, verse 7, just shows that Edom was in favor of burning Jerusalem to the ground. So no love lost between the two, kind of like there was no real love lost between the northern and the southern kingdoms. Once they split under Jeroboam and Rehoboam, they didn't care. They would go and they would do forays in and they would demolish each other and they would try to get the upper hand. So there was no love lost between the two. But Edom, as far as a nation, again, the base operating position that they took is that they were wronged. And that, if you keep that in your mind, that this is how they're looking at it, that these people who then come in and try to take over and do all these other things are promised, it's kind of like Ishmael and Isaac. This is why the whole of Islam is like, the argument is that they are the true firstborn of Abraham. There are so many similarities in beliefs. If you read through the Quran and you read through their beliefs, there are a lot of things that overlap because they're looking at Abraham as their father as well. And here we have Esau and Jacob. Esau's the older. It should have been him, and he's passed over. And so instead it goes to Jacob. There's this animosity, and we see this continuing on through this day. But because of that victim mentality, the mindset of loss of something that is owed to them, that, as we look at how they're being called out in the book of Obadiah for how they treated Israel, that's why. Because when you feel wronged, again, you will justify a lot of things that you do because you have been wronged. And so I think there's a big lesson for us for our mindset and what we allow ourselves to get into when we're thinking about that as we read the book of Obadiah. We'll dive into that next time, and maybe if we can get through perhaps who is Edom today, maybe I'll save that for after we go through Obadiah. But Mr. Samet.
Yeah, just a comment that you look at Germany and you look at a lot of nations and how brutal they could be, that there's a different mindset. As in the millennium, Germany seemed to be blessed. Assyria seemed to be blessed, you know, the highways and everything. And but you see Edom has a different outcome because of the thought characteristics in that. I know in Turkey, you know, there's the Kurds and a lot of different sects. So I don't want to, you know, what do I want to say, define something. But I remember my uncle, when I was a kid, he was in the Pacific during World War II. Pacific Theater. He said the one thing the Japanese hated, was scared of, wasn't the U.S. in that. He says what they were scared of were the Turkish soldiers. And he told a story about what one did, a whole platoon of Japanese one night. And that. So,
well, so that'll maybe get, dive into. Hold on to that. That might be part of the discussion when we talk about who is Edom today, because there are different postulations as to where they could fall. There's some that where you're tracking names. There are some where you're tracking different mindsets of how they're behaving towards the people who we can define as Israel. So that's a whole other. We'll save that one for later. But it's an interesting discussion because Turkey is one of the postulated ones. But we'll dive into that then. But I think that for us, we'll get into we'll maybe bookend the book of Obadiah here, talking about the background with Esau and Edom. We'll go through the book and then we'll talk about who it is or who it could be today or characteristics of it. But I think the biggest thing for us that I would like us to go home with on this is how we behave when we feel that we are wronged. What we allow to be in our mind not only affects us, but we clearly see it affects generations and millennia of people. And to your point, which we'll talk a little bit about when we talk about how Edom is treated in the millennium and when Christ returns, there is not any slack given. And it is talking about utter decimation. And the thing is, there are hearts with which God cannot work. And if we allow our heart to get to a point where all... Not at all.
Everybody made a mistake and God made them pay. Really, I mean, everybody got paid back. Jacob messed up and he got paid back. And yes, he got paid for his evil, but everybody got paid back and they all kind of made their own muddy pies out there and threw them at each other. Fortunately, Jacob, as you mentioned, was of a proper mentality. The mentality, God was working with heart, and Esau being an improper, just an angry heart. In the end, the Edomites are going to get paid back, and the Israelites are going to be blessed. And yet, Everybody's going to go through the suffering, even our nation suffering because we have messed up. But it's just kind of like, in the end, if you look at the final analysis, everybody gets paid back for what they did wrong. The other thing I want to bring up, our church has the commentary, and I think it would be good, Obadiah. I mean, for me, I got it. It's one thing to listen, I mean, as you're speaking, to listen to it, but you're getting more detailed stuff. It's good to read it and reread it.
Yeah.
You can kind of analyze things. I think it'll make your thing come out clearer if we all sit back and read that commentary first before we come to be able to see and understand the big picture. It's a lot of stuff we haven't really looked at much.
Yeah.
So you need to really dig into this.
Yeah, and so I am trying to make sure that I let everybody know where we are when we're doing these Bible studies. So hopefully, if you make the time to go ahead and go over because we have the full Old Testament Bible commentaries. I know that One of the announcements I forgot to verbalize, but I did put in our written ones, is that starting on Monday we have the Bible reading program, going through the book of Deuteronomy. Every 7 years you go through the law. That was a part of the weekly update from Mr. Shaby. You know, we do this so that we can come together. The point of the Bible studies here is not for you to just hear me. I can just wax on for ages. You guys know that. But it's a lot. I enjoy when you guys are also engaged and bringing out things, because there are things that you're going to bring out that wouldn't necessarily be what I might bring out. There are things that you might have heard in the news that bring something else up. And it is fitting for us to be going through this and to consider it. But again, if you read it ahead of time, and with such a long book like Obadiah, all 21 verses, it's tough. But even just reading the book and then the commentary for it is less than 3 pages long that we have on it. It's not bad at all. There's a lot to be taken from it to be able to discuss. So it's very helpful to do that ahead of time and then bring anything here, because it's iron sharpening iron. This is an opportunity for us to be able to help one another consider things. And again, I'm not going to bring all the same things up that you might be thinking of. So, all right. Thank you much. And with that, we'll end the Bible study and have a great rest of the Sabbath.